This is our January 2014 Rogue Valley Study Weekend with our brother Jim Cowie. His theme for the weekend is the Sabbath, its prophecies, principles, and prospects. And class number two is entitled, They Shall Not Enter Into My Rest. And we've taken an introductory reading from Psalm 95. Brother Jim, please.
Thank you again, Robbie. And we come back, brothers and sisters and young people, to have a look now at Israel's relationship to the Sabbath. And as I pointed out, Israel never really fully understood what God intended in laying down the Sabbath law. They didn't think hard enough about it, which of course is a fairly common human problem, as we're all aware. And because many didn't think hard enough about it, it became to them a problem. They saw the Sabbath as a negative. They saw it as something that was a matter of duress. You know, my children happened to go for a while to a Seventh-day Adventist school, which was better, considerably better than some of the public schools that were available to us at the time. And they got used to the idea that the children, the Seventh-day Adventist children, would say to them, well, it's Friday today, and at 6 p.m. everything stops. We don't do this, and we don't do that, and we don't do something else, and we can't wait until 6 o'clock Saturday night when we can be released from it. And my kids used to think that was quite funny. But really, it's sad, isn't it? Because there are people locking themselves up into a day doing nothing. And God never intended the Sabbath to be a day to do nothing. So we're going to see that principle here this afternoon in our second study. We just read Psalm 95, and the theme of that psalm is Israel's relationship to the Sabbath. And we've got much to learn from them. As I said, they never really understood it. And they missed the point, and so can we. And so this study is designed to make it very clear what God intended by the Sabbath. Not as Israel saw it, as an imposition. It is a time of opportunity if it is seen in the right way. Now this is what Brother Barling says in that wonderful book, Law and Grace, which many of you will have read about the law of Moses. And he's here talking about the Sabbath as a holy day. He says, the day was of such outstanding importance because it so concisely symbolized both the character and the ultimate end of God's purpose with Israel. It bore expressive witness as the Sabbath of rest that he had redeemed them with the aim of giving them rest from sin's bondage, repose after the toil of mortality. And he adds to that these words. To act as though the day was not holy to them would be to do despite to their calling, would be equivalent to a repudiation both of the privilege of membership of the covenant people and the unparalleled responsibility which went with it. As men treated God, so he would treat them. Those who by their attitude and actions treated their covenant status as of little worth would forfeit it by death. And so here he's dealing with the importance of the Sabbath and of the Sabbath principle. And sadly, of course, far too many in Israel did not see it for what it really was. I want to just go through a few passages to show the dominant position that the Sabbath played in the life of every Israelite. Let's start back in Exodus 31. Exodus 31 is the introduction of the law concerning the Sabbath day. It's in a very interesting context. In Exodus 31, we read this from verse 12. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak thou also unto the children of Israel, the family builders of Israel, saying, Verily my Sabbaths ye shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am Yahweh that doth sanctify you. So immediately we understand that the Sabbath is related to the name of our God. And the name of our God expresses his purpose. He who will become, he will be manifested in a multitude of people who have developed a character after his likeness so that they might give glory to him, not only now, but of course, most importantly, in the age to come. So this Sabbath law is intimately connected with the name and purpose of God. That's the first thing we find out about it. But he goes on to say this in verse 14. Ye shall keep the Sabbath therefore, for it is holy unto you. Everyone that defileth it shall surely be put to death. For whosoever doeth any work therein, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. So it's a life and death matter. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whosoever doeth any work in the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. Now here's an interesting word. You see that word perpetual, if you have the AV, that word perpetual is the Hebrew word olam. And olam means the hidden period and refers to the millennium. The hidden period, it's hidden from us now, but it's around the corner. It's soon coming. So here is the millennial period. So God is saying that this Sabbath law had relationship to that period. Of course it does. It pointed to the seventh day when the earth will have rest from the ravages of sin and death in measure, and then finally they will be abolished at the end of that 1,000 years. So he says in verse 17, it is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. Now that word ever is that same word, olam, for the hidden period, pointing to the millennial period. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Shall we go back to Genesis chapter 1 and 2? See, he's taking us back to the roots of the Sabbath. 6 days of creation represent, of course, 6,000 years on the day, on a day for a 1,000-year principle. 6 days of creation representing 6,000 years of human history, and the seventh would be a time of rest when dominion would be exercised again in the earth over carnality and ultimately over sin and death. That's what the Sabbath law was when it was given to Israel. Now, when they heard that, of course, they didn't fully understand what was being said. They thought this was an imposition. This was going to control their lives and stop them from doing things on one day of the week. They should have seen it differently, as we will see. I want you to come to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Now, we know that Deuteronomy is called the second law. It repeats, of course, much of what you read in the earlier books, Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers. Deuteronomy chapter 5, in verses 12 to 15, is actually talking about the fourth commandment, the Sabbath law. But I want you just to notice the context in which we find this. We'll pick it up from verse 12 of Deuteronomy 5. Keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it, to make it holy, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. 6 days thou shalt labour and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, manservant, maidservant, ox, cattle, etc. And it goes on in that vein. So what's God saying here? Well, we get to verse 15. And remember that thou wast a slave, as the word means, in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Now I want you to notice that word keep. It is the Hebrew word asar. And asar actually means to do. It's the word that's rendered, as we read in verse 13, 6 days thou shalt labour and do all thy work. Verse 14, in that thou shalt not do any work. It's also rendered in verse 10, showing, and showing mercy unto thousands. Verse 8, thou shalt not make, that's the word, asar in the Hebrew, thou shalt not make thee any graven image. So this word means to actually do something, to be active, to do something. And that's why verse 15 is very important, because it says this at the end of the verse. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to do the Sabbath. All right? So it's not a day to do nothing. It's a day that should be given to activity, but not your activity. Not the things you normally do. Not the things that belong to man. What God wanted men to do was to stop doing their own things. on the Sabbath so they could do his. He wanted them to do his work. And you know, he expressed this in a number of marvelous ways. For example, the priest's work doubled on the Sabbath. When did they change the showbread, for example? Well, the Sabbath. How many offerings did they make on the Sabbath? Usually double. The priest's work doubled on the Sabbath day. What was God saying to Israel? You know, you think about this. You've got people going around 6 days a week, busily doing, watching the priests. They're doing things too. Then comes the seventh, they stop. And they look at the priests. Huh? The priests are buzzing around in ever-decreasing circles, doubling their work. Huh? What's that about? You see, the thinking Israelite would say, God is trying to teach me something. He wants me to stop doing my own things so I can focus on his. That is the principle of the Sabbath. And as I said in our first study, when you understand these things, brothers and sisters, and you live the Sabbath, you live it every day. You put God's things first every day. That's the principle of the Sabbath. Verse 15, there's that word, asar, to do, to work, to act, to make, which is used so frequently here in this passage. Now, the same principle comes out of Ezekiel chapter 20. Very quickly, we've got to move on because there's quite a bit to come. Ezekiel 20, verses 10 to 26, we're not going to read that context. I just want to read a couple of verses. This same word, asar, is used here 12 times in this chapter. And 12 is the number of Israel. So God is trying to get a point through to Israel. This is what I want you to do. Verse 9, he says, but I wrought. That's the word asar. I wrought for my name's sake. Come down to verse 10. Wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness, and I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, asar, he shall even live in them. Moreover, also I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Lord that does sanctify them. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes, and they despised my judgment, which if a man do, there's the word, asar, he shall even live in them. And my Sabbaths they greatly polluted. Then I said, I'll pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them. But I wrought, asar, do, for my name's sake. See the way he's using that word? He's trying to get a message through Israel. You never understood this principle. In the wilderness, when you stop work on the seventh day, you sat there and twiddled your thumbs while the priests doubled their work, and you did not understand what I was saying. That's Israel's problem. Now, I want you to show you where this leads, because Christ picks up on this. I want you to come to Luke chapter 11. Luke chapter 11. You get this wrong, you have the idea of the Sabbath that the Jews had, this is where you end up. Luke chapter 11. Now this, of course, is all involved with the Lord's Prayer. We won't go into that side of it here. Just pick up this context from verse 21. So the Lord speaks a parable. He says, when a strong man armed keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. So who's the strong man here? What's the palace? And what are the goods? Well, you have to actually go back to verse 20 to find that out. Verse 20, he says, but if I with the finger of God cast out demons, no doubt the kingdom of God has come upon you. Now what you need to do is to put something, hand or whatever, in Luke chapter 11. You need to come back with me to Exodus chapter 8. Because this is where the Lord's quoting from. He's actually quoting the words of Exodus chapter 8 and verse 19. You know, this phrase, the finger of God, is rarely used. And here is where it comes from. Exodus chapter 8 and at verse 19. We just need to step back a verse or two, because this is about the third plague that fell upon the Egyptians. And we read about that in verse 16. And the Lord said unto Moses, say unto Aaron, stretch out thy rod and smite the dust of the land, that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so, and of course that's exactly what happened. In verse 18 it says, and the magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice upon man and upon beast. Then verse 19. Then the magicians said unto Pharaoh, This is the finger of God. So they acknowledged they couldn't do this. I mean, they were able to use Condi's crystals and turn water into red, look like blood. I mean, they could put a serpent in wax and then throw it on the ground and the serpent could be released. But when it came to lice, you can't even see with the eye. No, they couldn't do that. So they said, this is the finger of God. So this phrase occurs in the context of Israel coming out of Egypt during the plagues and coming into the wilderness. That's your context. And that's where Christ is. So come back to Luke chapter 11 and you'll see where his mind is here. Because he says in verse 21, when a strong man armed, read Pharaoh, keepeth his palace, read Egypt, his goods, read Israel, are in peace. But when a stronger than he shall come upon him, read Yahweh, the God of Israel, he taketh from him all his armour wherein he trusteth, read the overthrow of Pharaoh's host in the Red Sea, and divideth his spoils. Yes, Israel, when they left Egypt, spoiled the Egyptians. Got an idea? You see where he's going? He's actually basing this upon Israel coming out of Egypt. Then we read this in verse 23. He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth, which is a very important principle, by the way. Then he says this in verse 24. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, read Israel, because he's now been taken out of Egypt, so the nations come out of that land, he walketh through dry places, yes, read the dry, barren wilderness of Zin, and he's seeking rest, yes, seeking the land promised to Abraham, which was supposed to be God's rest for them. Like Psalm 95 said, they will not enter into my rest, he said. So going into the land was going into God's rest. Goes on in verse 24, and finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out. So what did they do in Numbers chapter 14? They said, let us make us a captain, and we will return to Egypt. We'll go back to the house of bondage. That's what Israel said. And then we read verse 25. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh to him seven other spirits more wicked than himself. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. You see what he's doing here, brothers and sisters? He's paraphrasing the experience of Israel's exodus from Egypt. And Israel never filled the vacuum of life in Egypt with positive activity for God. That was their problem. Never filled their lives up with positive things for God. They had this idea that the Sabbath, you do nothing. In fact, the Sabbath was to teach them to fill up their lives with activity for God. The principle is spelled out by Paul in Romans 12:21. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. That's the divine principle that is operable here in this context. And the seven other spirits, of course, implies the principles of the Sabbath being ignored by Israel. It could have been six other principles, couldn't it? Six other things. No, it was seven other spirits. Seven other ways of thinking, so to speak. They didn't understand the principle of the Sabbath. So let's now come back and resume our little review of what God said to Israel in relation to this matter of the Sabbath. I want you to come back to Exodus 12. Now, Exodus 12 is the introduction of the Passover. In Exodus 12, following the Passover on the 14th day of Abib, the 15th saw the beginning of a feast. It was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so we read about that Feast of Unleavened Bread. We pick it up from verse 14 of Exodus 12. It says, and this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and ye shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. Ye shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. Now that word ever is Olam, for the hidden period. This is all about looking towards that great day when a dominion will be exercised in the earth. And then you read in verse 15, 7 days shall ye eat unleavened bread. And it goes on in the end of that verse to say, from the first day until the seventh day, In verse 16 it says, in the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and in the seventh day a holy convocation. And it goes on like that, brothers and sisters. You get down to verse 19. 7 days shall there be no leaven in your houses. All right, let it keep leaven, which of course speaks of corruption. No leaven in your houses. What message is God trying to give Israel in the keeping of the feast of unleavened bread? He's pointing them to the Sabbath. He's saying, now listen, this is the principle. Deny corruption every day. Note the use of seven. Total rest can only be gained, of course, from sin in the kingdom. But we've got to try and live that principle today, to deny corruption. That's the principle of the Sabbath. And of course, as you go on, that principle is emphasized. You come to Exodus chapter 16, just a few pages on in your Bible. In Exodus chapter 16, verses 22 to 30, we read this. Now this is the chapter in which, of course, Israel in the wilderness is given the manna from heaven. And verse 22 says, and it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for one man. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And so the record goes on. But, there's always a but, isn't there? They were told you can collect manna for 6 days, but on the seventh, don't go out to collect it for 2 reasons. One, you're going to rest, and 2, you won't find any. But guess what human beings will do? Well, they'll test God. And this is the way human beings operate, isn't it? You know when mum and dad say, don't do that or don't go there? Well, you know what, you know, we do when we're young. You know, we've got to go there. That's the way we operate. So here we've got Israel foolishly doing what God said that they were not to do. Verse 27. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. Oh, that's amazing. That's what God said. You won't find any. But they went out just to see anyway. And we then read that the Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? And he goes on to express what this is all about. Verse 30, so the people rested on the seventh day. And they called this stuff that they found for 6 days manna. What is it? So what's he saying? Why did God prevent them from collecting on the Sabbath? Well, they had to rest. Now, feeding your family is about this life, isn't it? Had to rest. So he gave them twice as much on the sixth day that would last them through the weekend. So he's establishing a principle. He's pointing towards that great Sabbath rest to come. He's teaching them to live in hope. That's what he's doing. Live in hope of a better day. I want you to come to Leviticus 23. This again addresses this principle of the Sabbath. Now here we have a chapter that deals with all of the feasts that Israel were to keep during their year. 3 of them, in fact, and other minor ones. And the third great feast of their year was the Feast of Tabernacles. But there's something fascinating about the way that this is presented. To the thinking Israelite, it would have been a curiosity. Verse 39 is about the Feast of Tabernacles. Excuse me. Also on the 15th day of the 7th month, when ye have gathered in the fruit of the land, ye shall keep a feast unto the Lord 7 days. On the first day shall be a Sabbath, and on the 8th day shall be a Sabbath. Now it didn't really matter whether or not the first day, that is the 15th day of the 7th month, was a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Friday. If the 15th fell on one of those days, that day became a Sabbath day. And this is distinct from the Saturday. It was declared a Sabbath. Do you have public holidays in this country? Of course you do. Not as many as we have, but you have public holidays, don't you? Now that's like a Sabbath. People don't go to work, do they? Well, some people don't go to work on public holidays. So here is a special Sabbath, 15th day of the 7th month. So, what's it telling us? Well, you read there in verse 40, and ye shall take you on the first day the boughs of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, and the boughs of thick trees, and willows of the brook, and ye shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days. But hang on. Hang on. This is a Sabbath, isn't it? You don't work on the Sabbath. You can't go and cut down trees on the Sabbath. No, that's not right. See, the Israelite who thought about this would say, but hang on. What is God trying to say to me here? He's saying, I don't mind you doing my work. I don't mind you doing stuff that's for me on the Sabbath. I just want you to stop doing stuff for yourself. And of course, we do want to do things for ourselves most of the time. So he's trying to get that principle through to Israel, making them think about it. So labour was permitted. For what purpose? Well, let's read on. Verse 42. And ye shall dwell in booths 7 days. All that are Israelites born shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So why are they dwelling in booths? Because he wants them to rejoice. See at the end of verse 40? Ye shall rejoice before Yahweh your God 7 days. So when it comes to positive work that's got to do with his purpose and rejoicing in what he has done to redeem us from the land of the bondage of sin and death, that, brothers and sisters, is permitted. That's why the priests laboured twice as hard on the Sabbath, because they're doing God's work. Israel never understood that. And that's why they couldn't enter into his rest. Now, Numbers 14 is that awful chapter that deals with the condemnation of an entire generation in the wilderness. God made an oath based upon his own existence, a passage that we know very well in verse 21, but truly I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, but you are going to perish in the wilderness. And in this chapter, if you read it carefully, you'll see that life and death are sharply contrasted. So you've got God living, the guarantee that others will live with him. And he guarantees that to two men who are exempt from the condemnation of all those that were 20 and above, who would perish in the wilderness over the next 38 years. And of course we know who those two men were. They're mentioned in verse 38. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of the men that went to search the land, lived. The word still is not in the text. They lived. You see, it's like God saying, I live, all the earth's going to be filled with my glory, and Joshua and Caleb are going to be there to see it. They lived. It's a promise by God. But what about the rest? Well, verse 29, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. Verse 32, but as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. Verse 33, and your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms until your carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. And it goes on like that right through the chapter. You see, there's a sharp contrast being made between the destiny of some men from others. So here we've got God setting out this principle that some would live and others would die. Well, why did Joshua and Caleb have the promise of life? Well, because you see, they insisted that the land, the place of God's rest, could be taken by faith. Whereas the 10 faithless spies said, there are too many problems, too many hurdles. Look at those giants. We can't make this. They'll eat us up. No, Joshua and Caleb said, God will give us this land. He will give us his rest. And that's where they're heading. They got it, of course, temporarily when they entered the land, and they took their inheritance. But they're going to get it permanently when they're there in the Sabbath. They'll have an inheritance forever. Now, Psalm 95, we read. You know, Psalm 95 makes an interesting statement about God's feelings towards Israel because they did not understand this principle of entering into his rest. Let's just pick it up from verses 8 to 11. Harden not your heart, and you'll know that these words are picked up by the Apostle Paul in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4. Harden not your heart as in the provocation, as in the day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my work. 40 years long was I grieved with this generation, and said, it is a people that do err in their heart. They have not known my ways. They do not understand what I was trying to tell them, and to whom I swear in my wrath that they should not enter into my rest. Now, the swearing in his wrath is what Numbers chapter 14 is about. Surely I live, but you'll perish. And they did, of course, that generation. You know, brothers and sisters, the sad part about that is that that actually also includes the second death. You know, in John chapter 6, our Lord Jesus Christ said, your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and they are dead. Well, of course they were dead. It was, you know, it was 1,500 years before. Of course they were dead. He didn't mean they were dead in the wilderness. He meant they were dead, dead. Second death, dead. So when they appear before the judgment seat, there's no hope for them. They're gone. That's how serious that is. Because they did not want God's rest. We need to ask ourselves a question. What do we live for? We live for the present, or we live for the age to come? Where is our focus? You know, if you've got that focus, brothers and sisters, you know what's going to happen in your life? You'll give up. Give up wanting to do your own things, accept the necessities and what has to be done, and you'll give yourself for the things that belong to God. That's what that means. You'll forsake this life, as Christ said. Whosoever forsakes this life shall gain the next. But if you want to keep this life, well, then you may lose the next. That's the principle. It's as simple as that. Now, Numbers 15 is the tragedy revealed in a man. I want you to come back to Numbers 15. Now, some people have got a problem with this passage because it appears to be very harsh. Numbers 15 and verses 32 to 36. We read there in verse 32, and while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, and that, by the way, is the title, the Hebrew title of the book of Numbers. It's not actually called Numbers in the Hebrew. It's called Midbar, and Midbar means in the wilderness. So there's the title of the book in that phrase. So they were in the wilderness. They found a man that gathered sticks upon the Sabbath day. And they that found him gathering sticks brought him unto Moses and Aaron and the congregation, and they put him in ward, that's sort of like a guardhouse, because it was not yet declared what should be done to him. And the Lord said unto Moses, the man shall be surely put to death, all the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp. Now that sounds pretty harsh, isn't it? Here's a guy who's gathering a few sticks on the Sabbath day. Come on, there are worse crimes than that, aren't there? No. You know why? He despises the Sabbath law, and he represents in so doing the bulk of the nation who are about to be condemned in the wilderness and to perish in it. You know why? Because they didn't want the rest either. They despised God's rest. They didn't want his land. Keep your Sabbath, they're saying. You keep your rest. We don't want that. So he went out deliberately gathering sticks on the Sabbath day, thumbing his nose at the Sabbath that God's promised, the rest that God's promised. So God says to him, right, the whole congregation will pick up stones and stone that man to death. Why? Because sadly, the bulk of them were going to perish in the wilderness too, because they did not want his rest. They did not have the faith to get them into the land promised to Abraham. So he was a microcosm of the condemned generation. Now, this is one of the very few incidents that's recorded in the 38 years, in that period of 38 years. You only read of two incidents. The next one's in Numbers 16. It's about Korah, Dathan and Abiram. And what's that about? Well, he wanted to be the captain that would lead them back to Egypt. He was going to take them back to Egypt. See, two incidents, man gathering sticks and the rebellion of Korah, Dathan and Abiram. And the context of this is verses 1 and 2 of Numbers 15. So just come back to verses 1 and 2. So who was this chapter designed for? Well, these two verses tell us. Verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye be come into the land of your habitations, which I give unto you. So there's your clue. When ye be come into the land. Now the previous chapter, everyone 20 and above is condemned to die in the wilderness in the next 38 years. So who's he talking to? He's talking to their children. He's talking to those who are under 20 years of age. And he's saying, yeah, you've got 38 years to go, but when you finally come into this land, this is what I want you to understand. And what he goes on to tell them is very, very important for us. It sets the principles out. And the one phrase that keeps popping out of the page in Numbers 15 is the phrase, a sweet savour unto Yahweh. Now I want to show you where these are, and I would suggest to you that it's not a bad idea to have these highlighted in your Bible, and you'll see why in a moment. This phrase occurs six times in the chapter. It's there in verse 3. He says, when you make your offerings in your solemn feast to make a sweet savour unto the Lord. You'll find it in verse 7 when it says at the end of the verse, for a sweet savour unto the Lord. It's there again in verse 10 at the end of the verse. And you can have a look at verse 13. You'll see it at the end of the verse there as well. It's sort of a little bit past the middle in verse 14, of a sweet savour unto the Lord. And then you have it in verse 24. When it talks about, in the middle of the verse, for a sweet savour unto the Lord. He talks about a whole series of offerings that were to be made. We won't go into the details of that. All I want is to consider this phrase, sweet savour. Now you just read that on the surface. You know, it sounds like when they made a sacrifice, you know, when you have a barbecue, it's quite a sweet smell, isn't it, when you have a barbecue and there's a sweet savour. You could just say, well, yeah, that's what it means. It doesn't just mean that. It means a whole lot more. The word sweet is the Hebrew word rayak. It means an odour as blown and therefore a fragrance. The word savour is the word nikoak. It means restful or pleasant. Now the first occurrence of this word is in Genesis chapter 8, 21. So I'm going to ask you to come back with me to Genesis chapter 8. Now I'm going to put something in Numbers 15 because I might want to come back here in a minute. But in Genesis chapter 8, we read the very first time that this word, nikoak, is used. This is when they came out of the ark and Noah took certain animals and made a sacrifice unto his God. And verse 21 says, and the Lord smelled a sweet savour. Now if you have the same margin in your Bible that I have in mine, it says this in the margin. He smelled a savour of rest. Because that's what this word means. Nikoak means restful and therefore pleasant. Got to do with resting. Now you've got to just come back one or two pages in your Bible to Genesis chapter 6. In Genesis chapter 6, you read this in verses 3 to 7. Verse 3, this is in preparation for the flood. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for he also is flesh. Now we read about the giants in the earth, the men of great corruption. We see in verse 5 it says that God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, that every imagination of his thoughts was only evil continually. We read in verse 6, and it repented Yahweh that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. Yeah, grieved him. He had no rest in his spirit. He looks down upon the behaviour of men like he's doing today in the days of Noah when Christ will come again. What does God think about all the stuff that's going on in our world today? Do you think his mind's at rest? Do you think Christ sitting beside him is saying to his father, don't get so upset. Don't get so upset, my father. No, no, no. God looks down upon this world and he sees the behaviour of men and he knows that they deserve the judgments that are coming. He's grieved in his spirit like he was in the days of Noah. And it repents him that he made man upon earth. And we see the day's going to come when he will get rest in the millennium when his son will rule for him and exercise dominion and men will behave themselves in accordance with his principles. Then he will get rest. Now let me illustrate this to you. My wife and I raised four children. Thankfully, they were all baptized. You know, at least one of them is having a bit of a struggle at the moment. But you know, there were times when we raised our children and we endeavoured to apply divine principles and the necessary disciplines that we had rest. I'll give you an example. We were coming home from Bible school once and we went into a chicken shop, you know, a fast food place, like you've got many in this country. And there was no one else there. It was pretty late at night. We went in there and we had four kids. The oldest was probably about 10, 11, 12, thereabouts. The youngest was, you know, 5 or 6. And we sat around a table and we had our meal. No one came in. When I took the tray back to the lady at the counter, she said to me, she said, "You know, I've never seen a family like that. Your kids didn't say boo the whole time and just sat there. Never seen a family like that." Well, we didn't think that was amazing. There was nothing amazing about that to us at all. Because we'd applied some divine principles, had rest. But you've seen families who take their kids to restaurants, haven't you? The place is like a bomb's gone off in it. And there's absolutely no control at all. Are those parents having any rest? No. So when your children behave, you get rest, don't you? When they're misbehaving, you ain't having any rest at all. In fact, it's torture, absolute torture. And it grieves you at your heart that your children are behaving like that. That's how God feels about the creation in Genesis 6. And so when he wiped out 2 billion people with a flood, and out come 8 people, and the very first thing they do is make a sacrifice. He smells a sweet savour. Because, you see, there's nobody on earth now that's fighting him. There's no one despising his principles. He's got 8 people who want to serve him faithfully. So he gets a fragrance of rest. That's the principle, brothers and sisters. Literally that phrase, a sweet savour, can be rendered a fragrance of rest. So that when men serve God faithfully, he can be at rest. Like we can be with our children when they're behaving themselves. So you can see how important that phrase is, can't you, in Numbers 15. Now just in wrapping that up, this is the detail, which is really unnecessary perhaps, but it just reinforces. Nikioak is from the root Newark. Means to rest, to settle down. It is used of attaining the rest in the land in Joshua 21:44 and those references beyond. And of God's rest on the Sabbath, Exodus 20, and in other places. A cognate word is menukah. It's used in Psalm 95, verse 11. They shall not enter into my rest. And so on through the Old Testament. So you get a bit of a feel for the meaning of that word, which is rendered here, savour. Now, I want you to come to John 5, and I think we've got a little while. We can just finish off a couple of things here. John chapter 5. We'll have a look at a marvellous parable, a sign in the Gospel of John that just is staggering what happens here. You know what it's going to do for us? It's going to wrap all of these principles up in what Christ does in John chapter 5. All the principles we've seen in Israel and the wilderness, etc., are here. Now, John chapter 5, verses 1 to 18 is the third sign of John's Gospel. It's a sign about the impotent man who's healed at the pool of Bethesda on a Sabbath. Now, we need to establish that right up front. So have a look at verses 9 and 10. And immediately the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. Verse 10. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, "It is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed," they said. So we know it's a Sabbath day that this sign occurs. Now, we read about this pool of Bethesda. You see there in verse 1 it says, "After this there was a feast of the Jews," probably the Passover, "and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." Now, there is at Jerusalem, it says in the AV, the sheep market. And it actually should read gate. The sheep gate. This is the gate that they brought the lambs in to make sacrifices in the temple, you see. So by the sheep gate there's this pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having 5 porches. Now, Beth, of course, is the Hellenized, the Greek form of the Hebrew Baeth. So Baeth is the Old Testament word for house. So it's the Baeth Kesed. Now, some of you might recognize this word, Kesed. It's the one that God chooses in Exodus chapter 34, verse 6, to represent his own character of mercy. Or as Rotherham wonderfully and beautifully translates it consistently in the Old Testament, loving kindness. It's as close as you're going to get in the English to the Hebrew word kesed. So here we've got the house of loving kindness. And it's got five porches. Did you want to know that? Did you? I mean, it could have had 24 arches or, you know, 13 pillars, couldn't it? Did you want to know that? No. So why does God say it's got five porches? Well, because five is the number of divine grace. That's why. It's an architectural detail popped in there by the Spirit to teach you that this is the house of divine grace, divine mercy, the house of loving kindness. Now, think about this, brothers and sisters. Jesus came looking for just one man. Do you think he didn't want to heal everyone in there? This place was so crowded, there was not standing room. Why? Because the Jews had a tradition. So let's read on, verse 3. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. We'll come back to that in a minute. For it was said, this wasn't a fact, but it was thought, that an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water, and whosoever then first after the troubling of the water stepped in was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. So yeah, this was their tradition, that there was a time and the angel would disturb the water, and if you jumped in or fell in, then you'd be healed first. See? You can imagine, everyone wants to be as close to the pool as they can get. So all these sick people, blind and lame and halt, and they're all pushing and shoving each other, trying to get at the best spot, so that when the water's disturbed, they could drop in or step in. And Christ comes in, he's got to step over all these bodies. You know? Stepping over bodies. He's looking for just one man. He would want to have healed them all, but he doesn't come to heal them all. Have a look at verse 13. We read this. And he that was healed wist not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. Now the margin of my Bible says, Jesus had conveyed himself away from the multitude that were in that place. In other words, he only came looking for one man. So who was this man? Well, he's described in verse 5. And a certain man was there which had an infirmity 38 years. Now there's a vital clue. 38 years. From the condemnation of everyone 20 years and above in the wilderness, in Numbers chapter 14, it was another 38 years before they crossed the Jordan. And when Israel crossed the Jordan, brothers and sisters and young people, there was a moving of the waters. And the waters went back through the city of Adam. So this living water that came from the living sea, going to the Dead Sea in a serpentine course, which is a parable of human life, the water went back through Adam. When the ark representing Christ stood in the stream. See, there was a parable in that, wasn't there? And there's a parable here. So this man and many others were waiting for the moving of the water. He's like Israel on the border of the land, going into their rest. So what day is this that Jesus cures him? A Sabbath. Deliberately on the Sabbath, because that's when people will go into their rest. And Israel crossing the Jordan at the moving of the waters was a type of us entering into our rest in the land promised to Abraham. But there's an important principle spelled out in this sign of John. Look at verse 6. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now for a long time in that case, he said to him, Wilt thou be made whole? Literally, it should read, are you willing to be made whole? A whole generation perished in the wilderness because they were not willing to be made whole. And there's the question for you and me, brothers and sisters and young people and friends. Are we willing? Because if you are, you can enter the rest. But if you're not, like Israel, you're not going in. That's the lesson that comes from this parable, this sign of John. There's another word that's important here. It's the word whole. We met it in verse 4. Whosoever stepped in was made whole. At the end of verse 6, wilt thou be made whole? Verse 9, immediately the man was made whole. Verse 11, he answered them, he that made me whole. Get the idea? End of verse 14, behold, thou art made whole. So it's an emphasis on this word. It's the word hugies. It means sound or healthy. We get health from that. It's our English word, health. It's to be made sound or whole. There are six occurrences in this context in John chapter 5 and only one other occurrence in the whole of the book of John. And they all have to do with this same sign of John's gospel. So there's a reason. The Spirit's being very careful here in the way it's setting this forth. So let's have a look at what this is all about. Because verse 17 is a summary. Now it says at the end of verse 16, let's just read verse 16. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. But Jesus answered them, my Father worketh hitherto, or as it should read, until now, and I work. Weymouth says, my Father works unceasingly, even on the Sabbath, and so do I. He insisted on working on the Sabbath, because it's pointing to the day when he will exercise dominion in the earth in the millennium. Now, here's the sequel. John chapter 7. John 7 and verses 21 to 24. We read there in verse 21. Jesus answered them and said unto them, I have done one work, and ye all marvel. So what work is he talking about here? Well, he's talking about the work of John chapter 5, verses 1 to 17. He's talking about that man with the infirmity 38 years, representing Israel in the wilderness. And he goes on to say this in verse 22. Moses therefore gave unto you circumcision, not because it is of Moses, but of the fathers. And ye on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. Yeah. You circumcise a man. You cut part of his flesh off to keep the law. You'll break the Sabbath, won't you? If a child is born 8 days prior, you won't wait till the ninth day. You want to keep the law. So you'll break the Sabbath. And what you do when you break the Sabbath is you cut a part of a boy's body off. That's a negative thing, isn't it? So here you've got Christ saying what he does on the Sabbath. In verse 23, if a man on the Sabbath day receives circumcision that the law of Moses should not be broken, are ye angry at me because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day? All whole, fully restored. Got the point of that? So the Jews thought it was a negative thing. Christ saw the Sabbath as a positive thing. It was a time to do God's work. That, brothers and sisters, is the lesson that Israel never understood. They never appreciated the principle of the Sabbath, to be positive. And we're in our next study, God willing, we're going to see just how that comes out beautifully in Isaiah chapter 58. The spirit that we must have if we're going to be true Sabbath keepers. It's about positive building. Building up, not cutting off. Israel did that. And we're going to see that principle come out. We need to seek to restore and to build up that we might do God's work. That we might call the Sabbath a delight.